In the pulpit today, we have Reverend Emmy Lou Belcher. Welcome to this place. This is a home where no revealed truths are promoted and no scripture or a human being accepted as infallible. This is a place for searching for truth. But we are believers. We believe in intellectual freedom. We believe in justice. We believe in compassion and concern for each other and the whole world. We believe in commitment to those ideals which make us caring and active in the struggle for human dignity. We are Unitarian Universalists. I offer my welcome to you, and in particular to those who are first-time visitors. We welcome you and especially encourage you to join us after worship for potluck. There's chicken soup. Yeah, information about the church is available from the new member desk. All right. If you have children with you, they're invited to stay in the sanctuary because there is not. It's snowing and sorry. Or there is a nursery if they're young, because the nursery is fully staffed. We welcome everyone to this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. And on a personal note, thank you for showing up. Announcements. I've already announced the potluck, that there's chicken soup. And Lisa Strangman has a announcement.
Hi. Good morning, church family and friends. I come to you this morning with what will hopefully be the most exciting announcement I present all year. Abundance Sunday is coming March 22nd. What is Abundance Sunday? Abundance Sunday is the celebration of our giving abundantly as a personal and shared value. We will have a catered meal, and we will be asking for reservations so we can have a final headcount for our catering team. Why are we celebrating with Abundance Sunday? This time is intended to be a reflection on how giving to this church helps us to live out our personal values. As we approach Abundance Sunday, we encourage you to ponder this question: how does my giving fulfill my desire to shape meaning and worth in the world? We want to focus on the abundance all around. How does your sharing your abundance further your spiritual growth? I moved to Illinois in the fall of 2012 and felt bereft and adrift. Far away from the friends and family I had known all my life, I was nervous about what this huge change meant for me and my loved ones. After the first service we attended here, my husband Christopher asked me what I liked about the church. I told him it felt warm and welcoming and like I could have a home here. The people I see here today are my church family. You helped us move last summer. You've watched my children grow, and we've been happy to be here for all of you as well. I feel fortunate that we found this church. Abundance Sunday is all about sharing that feeling of being fortunate. We will see you Sunday, the 22nd.
Thank you, Lisa. We begin our service this morning with a prelude.
Thank you.
As Ben lights our chalice, please join me in reciting the words over there on the wall. Love is the spirit of this church, and service is law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another.
Good morning.
Good morning,
fellow hardy ones. I'm the Reverend Emmylou Belcher, and I've been a minister for about 30 years, and before that I was a DRE, so I've been at this business for a long time. And one of the things I do now that I've retired, so I'm only working half-time, so I've retired, is help churches that are in the search process. And I help the church and the search committee go through that process. My home is on the DuPage River, which is a small river compared to what you all have out here. I am on the west branch of that little river, and in the summertime, people kayak and tube and canoe along its banks. This past week, I watched the water slowly moving between shelves of ice along its sides. In the below zero temperatures, the water was like jello, just beginning to set. It was still flowing, but so slow that each wave took ages to play out. No people moved upon the waters, but during the day I heard a flock of geese arguing about who was going to be landing just where in this frigid water. It just proves the fragility of humans and the endurance of geese. Sometimes it seems slow and even cold getting to where we want to be as a people of high resolve and authenticity. But the quest for truth and authenticity is lifelong, not done in a quick or even warm and sunny day. I come today not as the harbinger of tough times, although these opening words may sound a little bit like that, but I come to help you start your process of searching for a new minister, to help you through the cold times and the warm times. Like the spiritual life itself, this will be a quest for truth and authenticity. It will check your temperature many times, ask of some of you unbelievable hours of dedicated time, and in the end reflect who you are as a unique congregation. The result will be a new minister with whom to work toward your dreams, toward fulfilling your mission as a congregation in this city, toward each of you fulfilling yourselves as persons of integrity and caring. As a river in winter, this process will begin slowly. It will sometimes run with spring and summer's fullness. Sometimes it will seem as though you're sitting on bedrock in a drought, and then rapidly increase speed until the end seems a riot of meeting a new person and deciding if that person meets your desires for a leader and a companion through good and harm times, hard times, warm and cool. Welcome to this journey. Let us begin by singing our opening song, which is number 16 in the hymnal. I imagine the words will be up here, and most of you know, 'tis a gift to be simple. I invite you to rise as you're able in body and spirit. I have a story this morning, and it has absolutely lovely pictures in it. If the children would like to sit in the front row or even come up so they can see them, I think it will be very nice. Yeah, you get to come up and sit in the front row. Can you see the pictures, though, if I have the book over here? Okay. This book was written by a woman who is a member of the Traverse City Unitarian Universalist Church, and her name is Lynn Ray Perkins. And a couple of years ago, she won the Newbery Medal, which is about the highest medal you can win for children's literature. It's like winning a Nobel Prize for children's literature. She won it for another book, not this one, but I've always liked her books, and she draws the pictures as well as writing it. And the people in the pictures are her and her family, even though they're often given different names. "Mom," said Andy, "can you tell me about that time when you were running because you were late for school and you tripped on a little chunk of sidewalk that was sticking up because of a tree root and you fell and broke your arm?" "Let's see," said Andy's mom. "I think I was in second grade." And this is Andy's mom, and that's actually Lynn. That's a portrait of her. And she looks like a 6 foot tall hippie with red hair. "No," said Andy's grandma, "you were in the third grade." "I must have been in the fifth grade then," said his aunt Cookie. This is Cookie. "Well, anyway," said his mom, "it was a long time ago." "Listen to this, Frank," Andy whispered to his cat. You see the cat sitting on his lap? "A whole group of us were walking to school. We were almost down the hill when we heard the bell ring. But it was it the first bell or the late bell? No one was sure. We all started to run. There were some huge old trees all along the way, and some of their gnarly old roots had broken and pushed up chunks of the sidewalk. And I tripped on one and went flying through the air. As I flew, I remembered that I was wearing my brand new glasses. I flung my hands out so that I wouldn't land on my face and break them." See how she's got her hands out in front of you? This is a warning. You never do that when you're falling. There's a reason. "It worked. When I crashed into the sidewalk, my glasses were saved. But the whole front of me was banged up and scraped and bruised, and my dress was torn. I wasn't very sympathetic," said Aunt Cookie. "I said, 'Stop whining and get up. We're late.'" Doesn't that sound like a big sister sometimes? "The school nurse cleaned me up and bandaged me, and she asked me if anything else hurt, but it was hard to tell. Everything was stinging, so I said, 'No.' And she sent me back to class," said Andy's mom. "But that nurse felt so bad about not noticing that your arm was broken," said Grandma, "especially when it was in the newspaper." "Tell how you couldn't do your writing test," said Andy. "I couldn't make my hand do what I wanted it to do, but I still thought my arm was just sore. I got a horrible grade on my writing test. After school, I was supposed to get ready for a birthday party, but I couldn't pull my socks on." "No, no, no," said Grandma. "You couldn't get your socks off to take a bath." Doesn't this sound like a family telling a story? Everybody remembers it differently. And when you little ones get older, you will experience the same thing. All your siblings and your friends will tell the story one way, and you'll tell it another, and your parents will tell it a third way. "And when you couldn't wash yourself, I called Liz to come over from next door to take a look, and there was a lump where a watch should be, but on your right arm. Liz says, 'Oh, Helen, I think you better have someone take a look at that.' 'Look at that lump,' says Helen. So we went to the emergency room." I was wearing my dress for the party, said Andy's mom. I love that dress. It was a hand-me-down from Aunt Cookie, and the top was peach with white rickrack, and the bottom was white with polka dots. I love that dress too, said Aunt Cookie. I was going to take you right from the hospital to the party, said Grandma. That doctor was such a nice young man. He was so gentle, but you didn't cry a drop while he examined your arm or while he got your x-rays. When the nurse pinned up the x-rays, I asked her, do you think it's broken? And she said, I'm not supposed to tell you, but yes, it looks like it's broken. And then did you cry and cry and you couldn't stop crying, Andy asked his mom. I cried and cried and I couldn't stop crying. Why did you cry so much, asked Andy. I don't know. I think maybe I was just surprised that a part of me could break. You were sobbing, said Grandma. I said, settle down. You're going to get that nice nurse in trouble. She wasn't supposed to tell. And when the doctor came back, he said, what happened? What's wrong? And you said, oh, I'm just tired. I cried the whole time he was putting on the splint and the cast and the sling, and I wouldn't go into the birthday party, even though they were having pizza. You were embarrassed that you were so late, said Grandma. I carried your gift up to the house. See, she's gone up to give the gift to the person at the house. I was embarrassed that my arm was broken, said Andy's mom. I was embarrassed that I was breakable. Why don't you come on forward so you can see the pictures of the rest of the story? Come on, just come and sit down. If you're over there, you might not be able to see. You might want to scrunch down up here. I was embarrassed because I had yelled at you, said Aunt Cookie. Liz and I went around and told everybody in the whole neighborhood that you had gone to the hospital, and when you got home, they all came out to greet you. She lived in a small town, probably smaller even than Alton, which may seem big to some of you, but then I live in Chicago. Frank, called out a voice. Andy and his mother and his grandma and his aunt stood up and walked across the room. Where are they, do you think? They're at the vet's emergency room with the cat. They went to a smaller room and Andy lifted Frank up onto the silvery tall table. It's okay, Andy whispered to his cat's ear. Hi, Frank, said the doctor. What's the trouble? He was fine yesterday morning, said Andy's mother. I let him outside, said Andy. But when he came back in, he crawled up onto a chair and he didn't move all day. He wouldn't eat his supper or drink any water, said Aunt Cookie. I put him beside me on my bed, said Andy. He didn't move all night. I kept waking up and checking to see if he was still breathing. He seems to be squinching his eyes shut tight, said Grandma. Said the doctor. She searched Frank for clues. She took his temperature. She pried open his eyes. She peeked into his mouth and down his throat. She listened to the small noises Frank made as her fingers felt his fur. It was as if she were a fortune teller and Frank were her crystal ball. See, Frank's making a noise when she touches his head. It looks as if Frank may have been in a fight, she said, probably with another cat. He's been bitten on top of the head. His whole head hurts. That's why he won't open his eyes or his mouth. Will he be okay, asked Andy. Yes, said the doctor. I think he'll be okay. Come to think of it, said Andy's grandma, I saw a big old brute sneaking out of your yard when I came over yesterday morning. The doctor carefully shaved the fur from around Frank's wound, and after that, no one could bear to look. But when it was all over, Frank had a tidy white bandage wrapped around his head. His eyes were open, but he did not seem to be happy just yet. Here's Frank with a bandage all over his head. See him? Mom, said Andy, did your arm hurt the whole time it was broken? No, said his mom. See, they brought him home, and see, he has one of those cone things over his neck. That's to keep him from taking the bandage off. Cats don't like to wear anything, including bandages. I got used to it. I had to sleep a certain way. Here she is sleeping, sort of with her arm outside the covers, and Frank is sitting up. I had to try to write with my left hand. Here is Frank eating, because they've taken the cone off his head so he could eat. When the bandage came off, my arm looked really skinny and pale, and I was a little bit afraid to use it at first. And here's Frank with his shaven head and the stitches all closed up. But pretty soon, it looked normal, and I didn't think about it at all. And here's Frank, the hair all grown back in, and he's up to his favorite trick, which is to try and pounce on people's papers while they're doing their homework. And that's the way it happened with Frank. Frank the cat. We all get broken every once in a while. It's called the broken cat. But almost always we heal. So I invite you to go back to your seats. That we have children here this morning, but no RE teachers.
I think we're going to go ahead, yeah. Since we have had a new influx of kids, I think I'll go ahead and take them downstairs.
Okay.
And hang out.
Oh, you'll like that a lot better. Okay, shall we sing them on their way?
I invite you now to move to the microphone and share briefly any gratitude or celebrations you bring with you to church this morning. There will be time to share concerns and sorrows in a few minutes.
I'll do Brenda's because I don't think anybody else said it. If you didn't see it on Facebook, Brenda's house in East Alton is finally going to be sold this week, and she wanted us to all rejoice with them since it's been forever on the market.
And I'm going to say it anyway, Isabella got a medal for her science project, and she's really proud of it, but she didn't want to say it herself, so, and she's gone. I invite you to move to the microphone and share briefly any sorrows or concerns you bring with you to church this morning. May the gratitude and the celebrations among us this day become a blessing to all, and may the concerns and sorrows be carried in all our hearts, a burden shared become a load lightened. We each receive from this church the opportunity to explore meaning, purpose, and value in our lives. How does the money you give reflect what you receive? As you give to our plate this morning, you're invited to consider how your spiritual life, that life of meaning and value and purpose, are enhanced through your giving. This morning's offering will be gratefully received, may be joyfully given. Please repeat after me the offering blessing. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves, and these are offerings.
I invite you into a time of meditation and contemplation. If you like, I invite you to rest your feet both on the ground, to sit back, and let the seat support you, and drop your hands on your hips, your lap. Now I invite you to close your eyes if you would like, to breathe in deeply and breathe out slowly. I would like invite you to imagine that you are taking a journey. What will you take with you? With whom will you travel, and where might you go? In the silence that follows, I invite you to imagine where you're going, who will go with you, and what you will take. I invite you to imagine setting out on that journey and disappearing from your home, from the place where you began. I invite you to come back into this room, your spiritual home, from which you take journeys every week. I invite you to breathe in deeply and breathe out slowly. And to join in singing hymn number 1057, which is fairly new to you, Go Lifted Up. once again. One evening, I was in the boundary waters between Canada and the United States, north of Duluth. The day had been one of portaging canoes and supplies and of paddling against the wind. When we finally got camp set up, we were drawn to the beach to bathe. As night fell, we stayed glued to the beach, watching the northern lights. It was though all the work of the day was being repaid in millions by the heavens. White lights cascaded down from the dome of the stars, shimmered in sheets, and flashed upon the darkness. We were exhausted but unable to leave the site to go to bed. When Lewis and Clark and their party, about whom all of you I'm sure know a lot more than I do, arrived where the Columbia River met the sea, they were similarly entranced. Before their eyes stretched waters to the horizons, gold circled and otters feasted. To reach this point, they had labored for 18 months, rowing and walking from St. Louis across the Rockies and down rivers of which they had only faint traces on old maps or in legends. They had come through territory peopled with sometimes welcoming and sometimes hostile groups. They had traveled through forests and mountains from which they could only hope they would emerge. They had lost one of their number along the way, and the rest were tired and often hungry. But they had uncovered, both on their way to the sea and on their trek home, unknown species of plants, animals, and customs of human beings that no one of their heritage had seen before. They kept meticulous notes, both diaries of their actions and records of their discoveries that would become treasures for generations to come. Although they moved through little traveled territory, today there's only one pass that they took that has not been converted to a road for automobiles. High in the mountains in Idaho, the Lewis and Clark Pass is still 1.5 miles from any roadway. And if one crouches low on the ground in the setting sun, one can still see the ruts left by generations of traveling. Poles between which were slung pelts to hold supplies that had been pulled by dogs or humans and then by horses in the days after the Spanish reached the plains. The person who set them on this trek, Thomas Jefferson, had both political reasons and curiosity behind his request of Congress to finance the expedition. He knew that Spanish, French, and other nationals were interested in marking this land for themselves, and the British were interested in claiming sole authority in order to dominate the fur trade. And in those days, the first explorer had a lot of influence over who could claim the land, of course, in the European tradition of claiming it. This convinced Congress to fund the expedition. As an interesting aside, opposition to Jefferson was so high in the Congress, does this sound familiar, that he had to go about this in a behind-their-backs proposal. But Jefferson was also interested in the content of these lands. What were they like? Who lived there? What plants and animals flourished there? Meriwether Lewis was given training before he left in botany, how to identify new plants and how to record them for scientists. He was also given training in rudimentary medicine by Universalist physician and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, in order to keep his crew healthy as he went. The point was for them to survive and to tell their tales. And an astronomer had taught him how to navigate by the stars. This last fall, I went to Monticello, Jefferson's home in Virginia, which has been restored as closely as possible to what it was there when Jefferson died. One enters a foyer about three quarters as big as this room, and it's a museum hung with war bonnets, animal heads, tools for the hunt, etc. It is what Meriwether Lewis had brought home to his patron. And how exotic it must have seemed to the diplomats visiting with Jefferson after the expedition. They had never seen the ceremonial headpiece made of feathers and leather that we call a war bonnet, and the paintings on buffalo hide depicting battles and hunts. I wonder what their reactions were to the stories relayed by Jefferson from the notes of Lewis and Clark. In Jefferson's garden were planted seeds that are still planted there today, brought back from the plains and the mountains. He declared that Indian corn, as he called it, was fit for consumption and could even be tasty. Before the expedition, at Jefferson's invitation, Meriwether Lewis was invited to come spend many hours in the library at Monticello. Jefferson owned the largest collection of books in the world, of maps, etc., about the land west of the Mississippi. All of these mark a long and well thought out preparation for a long journey of discovery. Over the next year and a half, you too will be taking a journey. It won't involve canoes, which is a relief to some, and a disappointment to others, I'm sure. But it will involve discovery and has a huge reward at the end, an even more amazing picture of what the future of this congregation and the religious lives of each of you will look like in the years to come. You are first going to choose an expeditionary crew. Jefferson chose Lewis, and Lewis chose his friend Clark. Lewis was a military man and thus could recruit people who were used to traveling in harsh conditions and eager to go where no one among them had gone before. And joining the crew at the headwaters of the Missouri was a Frenchman married to a Shoshone Indian woman named Sacagawea. She was only 18 when they started and gave birth almost immediately to a son. The woman and the child were to prove an asset to the otherwise all-male crew. She not only could converse with some of the tribes they would meet, but the presence of a woman and baby made sure the group was not mistaken for a war party. You are going to choose members of your congregation to form a team that will search for the person they think should be your next minister. As such, these people need not be adept at paddling canoes or speaking languages such as Mandan and Lakota Sioux, but they do need to be knowledgeable about this congregation, how it works, and what its dreams are. And they will need to get along with each other and be able to spend considerable time at this task over the next 18 months. You will need detail people and visionaries. You will not need people who are attached to only one aspect of this church, say religious education or Sunday services or social action or music or denominational affairs, or who just think it would be fun to belong to the search committee. I hope the people who belong think it would be fun to belong to the search committee, but they need more. You need people who are dedicated to the whole church and its various ministries, even if they're more familiar with one aspect than another. All of Lewis's and Clark's people had to be able to paddle a canoe, carry heavy loads, and follow orders. Your crew will determine its own directions, but each will need that basic dedication and self-discipline in order to do this job well. And your crew will have great maps to take them across this landscape. Besides a good handbook, the UUA has provided people trained in leading search processes to help you. Lisa Presley will be your district staff person while you're on this journey, and I will be your map expert. Others will give you help in determining search committee expenses, ministerial salary requirements these days, opening your eyes to the advantages of diversity in ministerial styles and backgrounds, and tools for uncovering the breadth and depth of this congregation's wants and needs. Your interim minister, Reverend Wolf, will be able to get you in touch with someone to address your every need as it comes up. Many years ago, it dawned on the Unitarian Universalist Association that congregations may not know how to conduct a search for a minister. Duh. What a thought. It's something that many of you will experience only once in your lives, and why should you remember how to do it? So the association began to set up a system to help you. That's where all the people I named before come in. And one by one, it was discovered that expertise in each of these areas helped congregations make the best choices for themselves. And of course, helped ministers to make the best choices for themselves too, because this is a two-way search. Ministers are searching as you are searching. They are looking at you as you're looking at them. When Lewis and Clark departed, they were supplied with sufficient black powder and lead for flintlock firearms, blacksmithing supplies, and cartography equipment. They carried flags, gift bundles, medicine, and other items they would need for their journey. Your team will be supplied with a copy of the Settlement Handbook for Ministers and Congregations. It contains timelines for each of the tasks, outlines of the tasks, and the reasons for them, and a set of frequently asked questions in the back. Think of it as your map. The congregation can have access to this handbook in order to know what's happening, but your committee will work in confidence. When Lewis and Clark disappeared up the waters of the Missouri River, they had essentially no communication with their government or president. Your search committee will inform you of where they are in the process every step of the way. But the names of ministers with whom they are conversing will not be revealed. This protects two bodies involved in this process. The ministers can apply knowing that their own congregations and other congregations with whom they are conversing will not be privy to the process. Ministers are not stupid. When we are going to move on, we frequently don't tell the congregation we're in, just in case you don't find another place. And then your own congregation is like, what? What? You have to come back? No, it's usually in confidence up to a certain point. And the congregation, in the end, will be presented with one candidate to vote up or down. This prevents splits within the congregation over which of the ministers being considered would be best for this group. And I have been privy to other groups that don't narrow it down to one candidate and watch congregations explode in the process. So that's why we do it this way. As Lewis read over a month in Jefferson's library, so your search committee will do a survey of the congregation. And this is your chance to speak out early in the process. The survey takes time to fill out, but your voice will be included in the results if you participate. When the last church I was in did a survey, they put it on SearchMonkey, and they warned everyone that, you know, with SearchMonkey, once you sit down and start it, you can't leave the table and come back. They warned everyone it would take 45 minutes to finish it. It's very thorough. The survey will ask who you are as a person, about your expression of your beliefs, about what you would value the most in a new minister, etc. And the survey has been written and refined over the years by those professionals involved in the search process. Each congregation uses the same survey, and thus ministers have a good field of comparison for understanding the uniqueness of each group that they are considering. This is indeed a two-way choice. The ministers can choose which congregations they want to speak to, as I said, and the congregations can both select the minister they want to consider and then vote whether or not to accept that candidate. Either side can turn down the other anywhere in the process. It almost never happens. So it is important to select search team members who can have tough conversations, who can keep confidence, and who are dedicated to finding the best fit for all areas of the church's activity. They will need to do reference checks. What I say is reference checks, reference checks, reference checks, reference checks. And some people are very timid about that. So you need at least a couple of people on this search committee that will get on the phone and ask anybody anything. No one person will be fully adept at every area of ministry. None of the ministers will be. People just aren't like that, are they? And ministers are, what a shock, are actually people. So the survey will give your search committee clues as to which talents are most important to you and which kind of personality you work best with. When this service is over, I will meet with the board of your congregation to talk about their role in this process and to lay out several effective ways a search committee can be nominated. We talked on the phone about this already. The board then selects the system. And when you have elected a search committee, when you have chosen the people with which you wish to place your trust for this endeavor, then I will return to meet with them, and then off you go. My role, I think of myself as the person who can converse in several languages, in Bostonian, in Altonese, in congregational, and in committee. I know the way up the Missouri River and westward across the mountains. I've been there before. Sound like Sacagawea? Does to me. I'm not 18, though. That was a long time ago. So let's get the crew assembled and take off on this journey into the unknown. And I can hardly wait to see the sea stretching before you, open-ended and populated with wonders as you greet your new minister. The last hymn, the hymn after the sermon that we have today is I'm On My Way. So let's stand up, let's put some bounce in it. I ministered in Detroit for a long time. I lived there for 20 years, and in Detroit people move when they sing. So let's do a little moving. Okay. Thank you. especially for a minion. I have to find your order of service because I didn't get one. I think it's back here somewhere. There it is. Okay. Okay. Can you extinguish the chalice? You have some words for that?
I was hoping you would do that.
Oh, okay.
And I, these are the ones. This one, right?
Yep. We receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let us gather them up for the precious gifts that they are, and renewed by their grace, move boldly into the unknown. By Sarah Moores Campbell. I invite you to carry this light within you until we meet again.